Stephen.
Hello, Stephen. How are you doing?
Oh, I am so glad to see the back end of this of 2020. It's you know, they say it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. No, it wasn't the best of times.
It was just the worst of times.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the best of times, and that certainly hasn't shown up yet. But 2021 looks to be like it. There are some good trends that have started up in 2020 that are leading me to believe that we'll have a better 2021, including the vaccine for COVID. But there's still some things that are active in 2020 that are going to be affecting our lives in 2021 in a deleterious fashion. But we thought we would take a look back over the past year, see some of the things that were big news and then went away, and things we'll be glad to see the end of. So it's a question, it becomes a question of, geez, where do you even start in a year this chock full of things? It's like when trying to list Trump's various violations of ethics. It's like, well, where do you start?
Yeah, it's like eating an elephant one bite at a time. It's just looking back, I mean, because we've been doing this podcast pretty much weekly, pretty diligently since for more than a couple of years now. And I go back and I look at the stuff that was hot topics at the beginning of the year, not knowing any of this stuff was coming. I mean, at the beginning of the year, it was the Conservative leadership campaign. And, you know, everyone was going, but well, is McKay going to be the leader? And Trudeau will be in tons of trouble if it's McKay. And then they got O'Toole, and Trudeau seems to be pretty safe with that choice by the Conservatives.
Well, it seems that, we were expecting a coronation, basically, of McKay. Everybody, the smart money was on McKay. And I don't think that anybody really thought Aaron O'Toole had the gas in the tank to go that far. Also, because he's not photogenic like McKay. McKay displayed several traits which seemed similar on the surface to Trudeau, a certain youthful appearance, youthful vigor. He's physically active, conventionally attractive.
Yeah, pretty well spoken, and
well groomed. Well,
not really the darling of the hard right of the Conservative Party.
Yeah, and everyone, the smart money was on. The question was, how much is he going to win by?
Yeah.
Not will he win? And it was interesting to watch that just erode bit by bit. You know, step by step, it eroded and it fell apart. And I think people were thinking that, you know, the smart choice would be McKay because of some of the surface similarities he presents to Trudeau, moderation and so on, things the Conservatives had not been known for and had been losing because of. And people thought, well, the Conservative Party is definitely going to go with the guy who seems to take some of the ground out from under Trudeau. And, well, no, they didn't.
No, and early on, too, there was thought that O'Toole was considered kind of a moderate in the Conservative Party, which, you know, is a sliding scale.
Yeah,
and a bell curve. They say, okay, well, you know, McKay was sort of on the centrist as well, and O'Toole is kind of, you know, not quite as centrist as McKay, but he's sort of not pandering to the crazy right wing of the Conservative Party. And then as soon as he gets elected, wham, you know, the memes start. I mean, it's he's got the Canada Proud guy, Jeff Ballingall, who's doing a lot of his communications. He's hired a whole bunch of the people who, you know, the post-millennial crowd. I mean, the publication, not the demographic people. Group.
Yeah.
And and he just sort of jumped right in with both feet to the hard right, the intolerant, xenophobic, I mean, you know, all of those labels, end of the conservative part, the, you know, the Trudeau hating, you know, not just we disagree on policy, but the real kind of kind of stuff about, you know, you kind of expect them to be retweeting things about Fidel Castro being Justin Trudeau's father. I mean, it's sort of that level of discourse that is coming out of the meme factory that O'Toole kind of became the head of as leader of the opposition. You know, not exactly a constructive opposition, as we've said a couple of times, but
yeah, we may have dropped that suggestion a couple of times.
Yeah, may once or twice, you know, just obstructionist, whatever Trudeau says, the opposite's got to be true. And, you know, and here's three insulting half-truth memes that are kind of childish and sophomoric, but it feeds the base. So O'Toole has been one of the stories of 2020 that, you know, will it bear fruit? I mean, they're talking now about 2021. Trudeau has just said in a recent interview that, well, you know, I don't want an election in 2021, but we're ready for it.
I think he's lying. I think he does want to. I think he wanted an election in the fall of 2020.
It's like, bring it on, guys. We're ready for you.
Yeah, no,
you hope they don't, and you know, you hope they don't muff it if they're, you know, because you know the Liberals are great at, you know, dropping the ball at the 5-yard line when it comes to a lot of this stuff. But you know, you hope for their sake that they are ready and it's not just going to be another big mess. But I think you're right. I think, you know, they would welcome an election. They've been fundraising like crazy. The NDP is nowhere. The Greens are going down.
Well, the NDP actually has been rising rather consistently as the Conservatives have been sinking. The Conservatives have lost about 6 points on average, and the NDP has risen by about the same number of points, which is rather interesting. I think, though, when an election comes, the NDP will lose those points to the Liberals.
Yeah, well, you know, everyone certainly has their core base, and the question is whether or not they can break out of it. You know, the Conservatives seem to be doing their absolute best to alienate their popularity, the popularity among centrists and moderates and all the rest. You know, if I'm just looking at the most recent CBC poll tracker. So the NDP is at about 18%. You know, they tend to hover around 15, 16%. So yeah, they're up a little bit.
Well, they were at 13% for a long time.
Like, oh, yeah.
Stalled at 13%.
Yep. And the Greens are down around 5.5%. You know, they're again, big enough to be spoilers. Not the Greens, but the NDP, but, you know, certainly not within reach of forming any kind of a government.
Well, does anybody really believe? And I guess in these volatile political times, you can never say never, but I think you'd be safe with your money if you're betting against the NDP forming a federal government.
Yeah.
And I think that people are rewarding the NDP for what they perceive as the NDP standing up for the little guy during this whole COVID thing. But when it comes down to voting, I think people will give the credit to the Liberals for helping the little guy out as much as they have. And the NDP, I mean, it was only an aberration when the late Jack Layton was leading the NDP that their numbers didn't drop. As you know, as the election wore on, that their popularity didn't drop, because usually the NDP go in with a certain level of popularity, and it drops, or it goes up a bit, and then when the final tally comes through, it has dropped back to what their traditional ceiling is, and I don't see how that's going to change in 2021. And I do believe there will be an election in 2021. Everybody's been flirting with it. The parties are trying to get themselves ready. It would be, how many years would it be for the government, the present minority government, if they have an election in 2021? 2 years?
Yeah, about 2 years.
So that's about the age of maturation for these kinds of accommodations between parties. And I think that once COVID has been, the back of COVID has been broken, there won't be the same backlash against whichever party triggers an election. Right now, any party that triggers an election during COVID is going to reap the whirlwind.
Oh yeah, they will be punished.
Yeah.
And you've got to think the conservatives, you know, I mean, things change. We know that things things can change quickly in politics. But again, you know, looking at the CBC Canada poll tracker, the most recent numbers, which doesn't just do, you know, popularity, but they spread it around in the seats to see how the seat would end up. Because, you know, of course, the conservatives will, you know, will sweep Alberta and parts of Saskatchewan and you know, the 705 in Ontario. But, you know, the probability of winning a Liberal majority is predicted at 43%, and the probability of them winning the most seats but not a majority, so a minority, again 47%. And at the moment, the Conservatives, according to this, only have a 9% chance of winning the most seats, and the NDP, they don't even mention it. It's not even a footnote here.
They're
not in it.
It's like, if you have to ask,
they're not going to be a minority or majority government. So that, you know, the Conservatives got to look at that and go, well, we got money in the bank, but does O'Toole want another loss under his belt?
Well, they're going to have to wait for some other Trudeau government scandal. I put that in air quotes because the last scandal really wasn't scandalous. But they're going to have to wait for some misstep by the Trudeau government that they can seize on that will cause the government to fall into disrepute. And, you know, based on the Trudeau government track record, they're good for about one of those a year.
Well, and they've been remarkably resilient because they went into the last election with SNC-Lavalin just sort of trailing along behind them as the scandal that they had to overcome to get into, you know, to get into government. And, you know, last, you know, this past year, you know, the scandal has been, again, air quote scandal, has been we, which, you know, the opposition party's milked for all it was worth. And you and I have had a couple of talks about that, about it being, you know, not the scandal it was meant to, that everyone has billed it to be, or you know, and really just a tragedy that Canada has lost a major charity that was actually doing tons of good work. But the NDP, you know, Charlie Angus is still trying to get it in front of various committees and trying to get to the bottom of it and get more documents and look at bank records and the whole thing about Margaret Trudeau speaking at WE events and her, you know, the other breathless thing the Globe Mail had was, you know, she got, you know, like $28,000 in travel expenses for eight trips you know, speaking engagements where she had to go to different provinces to do it. And isn't this, you know, it's like, oh, really? That's so Canadian.
Oh, it's exceptionally Canadian. And excuse me. It's a shame that the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals don't get involved when you're beating a dead horse, because Charlie Angus and Pierre Poilievre would run afoul of those regulations. I think that if I had to pick one of the saddest things that happened in Canada this year, it is what happened to the WE charity. It was a hatchet job the media was complicit in because it helped to get clicks and drive sales. But here was a charity that really did do a lot of good. I mean, in some ways, they flew too close to the sun, like Icarus. But that was necessary. Their hobnobbing with celebrities and famous people was necessary because those are the names that drew people in, paying people in to their rallies and to their speaking engagements and so on. But they really were a charity that did good. And they were a Made in Canada success story started by children. You know, it was a charity for children started by children. It was first world children giving a damn about third world children. And those children that formed it eventually grew up into adults, but they continued to operate this charity. And the charity did do good in the world. It did get high ratings in the world. And just for the sake of trying to bring down the popularity of a prime minister, the opposition rubbed their hands in glee or with glee at the option or the opportunity of destroying a charity simply as a sacrifice to try to win themselves a little bit more voter support or enough voter support that they could, you know, reasonably consider running an election and winning. And it's tragic because now we've all moved on. the Liberal Party has moved on. Justin Trudeau's popularity is very high. The Liberal popularity is very high. And yet we is left, the wreckage of we is left behind, and the wreckage of the Kielbergers. And while I always felt that, which was, there was Mark Kielberger and then the other one, I forget the other one's name, Craig. Yes. I always felt that Craig Kielberger was a little bit too much of a celebrity whore and a media whore. I felt that he came across as sanctimonious and supercilious, but nonetheless, they did put together a charity that did well and did good for people. And part of the tragedy is they were trying to do good for Canada. They were really willing to administer a program at basically cost, not even, you know, barely any amount for expenses, at cost. They were attempting to do good for the country. Other charities were asked and they wouldn't come in at that lower rate for their fees. They were really trying to do something good, and no good deed goes unpunished, and neither did theirs. And that's, I think, tragic. And it's an example of the toxic relationship between that has developed between a political opposition that is just starving for anything to create a chink in Trudeau's armor, and a diminished and click-hungry media, the news media, that is looking for anything juicy that they know will draw people in to read. And of course, the hint of scandal draws people in, it draws in readers, it draws excitement. So we've seen these two forces join together, and they destroyed something good in the process, something concrete good in the process, not just goodwill, but something that was actually physically making the world a better place.
Yeah, and like you said, the media was incredibly complicit in this. I mean, for two reasons. Well, you know, one of them was, you know, the obvious one, which is, you know, bad news is good news. It creates clicks. It creates readership, and you know, they context is difficult. I mean, you know, we've talked about sort of the intricacies of charity law and how the stuff that we did, you know, whether they had a real estate arm and they did that instead of putting their money into a foundation somewhere that just sort of sat on money and collected the interest. How was, you know, there was absolutely nothing wrong with that. And there was absolutely, you know, nothing illegal. But, you know, the media didn't give context. It didn't give explanations. It really preyed on the public ignorance of how these things worked in order to puff up the story and sell papers. And, you know, so that's one. The other one is, you know, post-media really is a conservative mouthpiece, whether it's formal or informal. They're certainly aligned with the current conservative party, you know, the Harper creation, and, you know, now carried on under O'Toole. And, you know, I don't think they're necessarily working hand in glove with them, but they certainly have aligned interests. And, you know, between, you know, their really, really large media empire, which includes, you know, all kinds of papers, sometimes several in the same market, they amplify these stories back and forth, and they really don't like the Liberals. They really don't like Justin Trudeau. And you get the sense that some of it was sort of juicing the story a little bit because, you know, they didn't like the politics. And I think that is a sad commentary, because we've seen what's happened in the United States, the polarization of the media. We've seen how, you know, certain media, especially Fox News, has been absolutely complicit in the absolute travesty of the Trump presidency, how they drive stories, how they drive the narrative, which isn't, objectively just, you know, is not accurate and faithful to the truth. And I would hate to see that really take hold in Canada, because, you know, we always had the CBC, which was sort of the boring, even-handed voice, but even the CBC was being politicized, certainly under Harper it was, by cleaning out the board and making it more of a political org, you know, and then underfunding things. So I have trouble even watching some of the CBC shows now, because they still they have cast themselves in the role of the opposition to the government. And media is not there to prop up the government, certainly, but it is there to be fair. And, you know, when you see sometimes the panels that you get, you know, in Power and Politics and some of the other ones, you just go, things that are being said that are completely untrue, that are being left unchallenged. And while, you know, if it's a political talk show, you can't just let people say any stupid thing that meets their agenda. You know, you've got to test it. You've got to call them on it. You know, the United States press has tried to do that with very limited success over the last 4 years. But, you know, in Canada, we're used to a little bit more rigor when it comes to testing politicians of all stripes.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that when I was at CBC, this is a few years back now, when I was working at CBC a few years back, there was a, I don't know if it was a if it was officially a directive or if it was just a bunch of people got together and decided this is what they needed to do, but they were very sensitive to being labeled as being liberal, big L liberal. And so in their attempt to be fair and balanced, they bent over backwards to show a conservative point of view. And because they themselves don't believe that point of view, the people putting together these stories and putting together this media, it was liberals deciding what a conservative would want to read. And so stuff was often tone deaf, went too far in trying to mollify conservatives and conservative critics. And I've seen that continue going forward. As you say, they've cast themselves as the opposition to the government, and good media does hold the government accountable, but they don't participate in political assassinations. And that's what was going on during the whole We scandal. That's what was going on during the SNC-Lavalin, the Jody Wilson-Raybould situation. It was, the media was being, most of the news media was being complicit in the narrative being spun by the opposition parties. And that's not something that we are used to having here in Canada. We're used to having at least the CBC being, as you said, the boring, factual, balanced news organ, not exciting because it didn't buy into these, you know, clickbait campaigns. And now we see them being sucked into the same culture of clickbait campaigns. And it's disturbing because it becomes very difficult to find an outlet that doesn't make you want to pull your hair out when, you know, you read headlines. And sometimes, and CBC is guilty of this too, the headline and the story do not agree with each other, or the headline leads you to think in a certain direction, sort of has implications in its wording that are not borne out by the actual story, but people are aware who are putting this stuff out that most people will just glance at the headline. And so the information they take in is something which is misleading. Whether it's deliberately misleading, I don't know. I think it's written to try to sizzle and draw people in to the steak. But I think more often than not, all people get is the sizzle, because all they're looking for is the sizzle. And they think, why do I need to read the whole article? You've summed it up for me in the headline. And the headlines are not written by the same people as write the articles.
No, exactly.
And people are mostly not aware that that's the case, that the headlines are written by editors, and that there are some reporters who and columnists who disagree with the way their work is presented, under the headlines that it's presented with. And that's why it's important to make sure you read articles. I remember people sending me articles over the past year, year and a half, maybe longer, trying to prove their point about something. And I would read the headline of the article and roll my eyes, but I'm going to read the article. And I read the article, and the article dismantled the argument it appeared to be putting forward in the headline. And I'd say to the people, did you actually read this? They said, no, it says it right there in the headline. I said, yeah, but the story tells a different story. And I think it's telling that a lot of those people just sent me stuff based on headlines. We're in the age of headline journalism, and headlines have always done what they could to entice people to read the story. That's not new. It's the degree to which they're willing to go into the territory of misleading people or potentially misleading people. That is new, the degree to which that is going on in mainstream media in Canada. And I find it disturbing, and I don't see it going away anytime soon, because traditional media, legacy media, is still in a death spiral in Canada. And they're still trying to, you know, it's almost like they're somebody's grandfather trying to win a rap battle. You know, they just don't have the tools. They don't have the mindset. They think they understand the form. They think they've understood and analyzed the form. And they think that they can do a good job and that they can compete, but they can't. The best thing they can do is be something that people can rely upon, because people are eventually going to start looking for reliable media. And right now, I can't point anybody to one particular source and say, well, I trust that source. I trust that they don't play fast and loose, or they don't play, you know, they don't put on headlines that are monkey business.
Yeah. And you know, my family's been in the newspaper business for
newspapers.
This is the 100th anniversary. My grandfather got his first job in 1915 with a newspaper. You know, I think he was a copy boy, but he went on to do other things there. But we've had someone in the newspaper business without a break since 1915.
So 105 years on, going into 106. Oh,
I'm sorry. Yeah, not, it's from 1920.
1920. Okay.
1920. When he was 15 years old. And it's so, you know, I've
now they write headlines for 15-year-olds.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, exactly. And it's changed an awful lot. And, you know, I'm not under any illusion that newspapers don't have a political or a social bent. I mean, you know, the Toronto Star, which, you know, my family's been involved with for a long, long time, was always, you know, it used to be known back, you know, 30 years ago as the Trudeau Daily Star, because everyone said they loved Trudeau so much. But if you actually looked at the paper on a day-to-day basis, they could be pretty sharp and critical of Pierre Trudeau, as much as they loved him. You know, they were just, you know, in some ways a little fairer to him than the other papers that were much more conservative. But so I've always read the news with an eye to bias, an eye to, you know, checking, you know, reading the article. Like you said, there's actually something, I don't have it with me right here. I think it's in the other room. The Toronto Star today had a headline in the front section that had a quote. I'm not sure what it was about, but it said, experts say this. And I read the entire thing, and there isn't a single quote from an expert in there. And I said, well, either it got cut by an editor, the actual quote by the expert identifying who it was and what they said got cut for space, or the headline reader saw the people who were quoted, who were politicians and hardly experts, decided that they were experts and needed a punchy headline. But headline writing is, like you say, really difficult. It's done by different people. And so much of the stuff is now being done by freelancers, by amateurs, as an afterthought, by people who've got way too much work because all the newsrooms have been downsized. And, you know, they, like we've said, they're competing with Facebook and, you know, the people who don't care about lying in their headlines, the rebel medias and the post millennials and all the rest whose stories are taken with a very, very, very large grain of salt. Because they're, you know, they're not actually news. They're more propaganda / infotainment with a conservative bent. You really have to be a sophisticated consumer of news these days. And it's like self-serve gasoline. It's like being your own retirement fund manager. You've got to curate the news yourself these days, because no one wants to hire anyone to do it. Or if they are hiring someone, it's an 18-year-old out of high school who's good at web design. And it's not old newsmen, newswomen who have experience in fairness at the same time as making something compelling and accurate, because they know they're competing against, you know, all the other stuff that people are going to see on Facebook, because everyone has got their own paper, their own blog, their own video thing, their own podcast. And yeah, and there just isn't those standards of ethics, of fairness and accuracy and checking your sources anymore, because everyone's rushing to get the scoop and everyone's, you know, fighting to get the clicks.
Well, and an aspect we can move on to, which ties to this, is that there's an audience for that. There's an audience for Trudeau hating and so on. And I think we've seen in the past 12 months, a lot of via osmosis conservative, American conservatism, or I should call it what it is, American Trumpism, come to this country. And mostly it's settled in Alberta and, you know, parts of Saskatchewan. But we see the Conservative Party in Canada claiming that they don't have any trucker trade with these racists and with the Ontario Prouds and with the Proud Boys and with groups of that nature. But at the same time, they do tacitly welcome them into their fold. And I'm wondering what you think. I mean, this all stems from Trumpism in the States. And right now, it's, as we record this, there's still serious talk about a Trump coup, declaring martial law and invalidating elections in swing states. So it's hard to predict if Trump is actually going to go out the door January 20th or not. What are your thoughts on that first?
Well, I mean, one thing that 2020 has really taught me is something that, you know, you always suspect, but you never really want to acknowledge as being true, is, you know, we've learned a lot about human nature in 2020.
Sadly.
And, you know, small L liberalism is built on the idea that given enough education and information and the proper opportunities in life, you know, to travel and to experience other cultures and all that, will create a smart, tolerant person who will respect science, who will respect facts, who will respect other people, you know, who know right from wrong, just sort of instinctively. And 2020 has really shown us that that's really not true. I'm not sure where you go with that, because, you know, if you're a small L liberal, it's like, ooh, that's a pretty grim observation. But you see people who are still, I mean, we're in the middle of this pandemic, well, middle, I hope we're in the, you know, the final act of it, but it may drag out for quite a bit longer. But the United States, as an example, we'll start there because it's, you know, it's easier to pick on them. Even as we speak, the airports in the United States are crowded with people who are traveling all over the United States to visit family for Christmas. And I would love to visit family for Christmas. I saw my sister at the end of my driveway yesterday. It was great to see her. And I think it was the first time I'd seen my sister, who lives in Toronto, since February. First time I'd seen her face to face. There are things you've got to do in order to keep the pandemic under control, keep yourself safe, keep your family and loved ones safe. And the Americans, whether it was their Thanksgiving or Christmas shopping, or now Christmas travel, they're just like, no, we're not doing that. I don't care about other people. I don't care about, you know, either. I don't believe the science. I don't believe I'm at risk. I don't believe I'm putting other people at risk. I'm going to do my Christmas shopping. My Christmas is more important than public health, than the welfare of my fellow citizens and my friends and neighbors. And so screw all you guys. I'm just going to get on a plane. I'm going to crowd the malls. I'm going to buy all kinds of stuff. I'm going to get together around the dining room table, and we're going to kill grandma. And you kind of go, you despair. You know, the United States is easy to pick on, but in Canada, in Toronto, you know, we've had a very vociferous group of anti-COVID, anti-maskers who are parading, and, you know, they have cars going up and down Yonge Street, across Bloor Street. They're stopping traffic. They're going to dodgy barbecue, unlicensed barbecue places, like that's some sort of a human right. and getting into tussles with the police when the police are saying, look, no one's wearing a mask. This store needs to be shut down. You can't have indoor dining. And it's accumulating large crowds of people. And, the guy who had the barbecue place in Toronto, he got shut down briefly because they let him open up again, which is beyond me. He was fined for what he did. And immediately there was a GoFundMe with like $300,000 that was raised. So you've got to think there's a lot of people who just still do not get it. And, from public health into politics in the United States, with Trump behaving 2020, he's behaved so badly, like beyond the pale. This isn't cute. This is dangerous territory we're in. And America has only been saved by the fact that Trump is such an idiot. And the people around him are the Keystone Cops. They are just klutzes and idiots, and they can't organize a two-car funeral. That was the problem. Just the best people. But if Trump had been good at this, if Trump had been smarter, if he had been, he had attracted more people around him who were competent, just as venal and evil as him, but competent, the United States would be gone. I mean, as we and they know it, it would no longer be a democracy because he would have subverted the democracy. He would have pulled a Putin. He would have pulled, Hitler had all kinds of really clever people around him who are good at the machinery of the state and were, they were very good at the business of evil. Trump never really found those people. He relied too much sort of on family and Giuliani and, the Scaramucci's of the world, not the brightest thinkers. But if he had been better at being an autocrat, he could have moved into Putin territory, I think, quite easily. And you saw the fragility of the American democracy laid bare by its inability to do anything except for wait for the election and then hang on. Well, we're still, the Americans are still fighting the election. I think it's a foregone conclusion. But like you say, the idea that a U.S. general who was going to be national security advisor would even float the idea of invoking martial law and rerunning an election so it favors Trump, that is just unthinkable, you would have thought, but here we are talking about it.
Now, let's just say that Trump does leave office. Do you think that Trumpism diminishes because it is based so heavily on people feeling like winners and now they're losers? Do you see Trumpism, the bloom off the rose? And in which case, do you think that will translate to the rise of Trumpism in Canada also deflating?
I don't know, it's hard to get that genie back in the bottle because there's so many groups, and it isn't just politics. I mean, it's social media and the internet and all the rest. So the Proud Boys can organize themselves. It used to be three sad guys in the basement talking about why women don't like them. And now it's a movement because they can connect, they can organize, they can do it cheaply, and they can kind of keep the pot stirred, and they can attract new members who want to wear the polo shirt and go out on the weekends and march around with tiki torches. So they've created a movement out of a crackpot idea. And the same with the militias, with the goofy guys who were trying to kidnap the governor of Michigan. There, all these groups now have a base, and I think some of them will fall off, but a lot of them I think are here to stay for a long time because they do live in their own world now. I mean, they can live in their own virtual reality. They can share ideas with like-minded people and be reaffirmed in their hatred of whether it's Jews or Catholics or Hispanics or the Chinese or whatever you like, women who use the prefix doctor in front of their names because they actually have some education. I think they're around for a while. Whether or not they find political power, it's like you said earlier on, it's disturbing that all the right-wing parties in North America, the Republicans and the Canadian Conservatives, both pander to that base. They're afraid to let it go because it is their rock base. You know, it used to be a fringe of that, of the party, and they had nowhere to go. There was nowhere further to the right that they could go. You know, if you were like that, you were a conservative because there's nothing more conservative than the conservatives.
Yeah.
So they were a safe vote, and a lot of conservatives, you know, especially of the progressive variety, they didn't pander to them. They thought they probably would get their votes, but they weren't a big constituency to begin with. And they also weren't a group that wielded any real power in the party. And ever since, you know, the Tea Party in the United States did a reverse takeover of the Republican Party, and then, you know, the Tea Party became the Trumpists. And in Canada, you know, the Conservative Party reverse takeover by the Alberta Reform Party, which was much more conservative, much more evangelical Christian, much more American in its outlook, because Alberta tends to look south for its inspiration as opposed to east or west. The parties themselves were the subject to sort of this parasitic infection that came from the extreme right, and it's now taken over the body politic. And I don't know why. McKay's problem was that he wasn't pandering to that group enough, and so he couldn't become the leader of the party and swing it in another direction because he didn't have the support of the party members. Forget the public at large. It's the party members who pick the candidates. It's the party members who pick the leader. And if the party members are motivated people who are on the extreme right of the party, and they can organize, whether it's on the issue of abortion or immigration or deficit fighting or any of the hot buttons, then they are the ones who pick the leader, and then they own the leader. And the leader has to, you know, he remembers who brought them to the party, and he's got to dance with them.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how much of the vitriol and the divisiveness of 2020 winds up being continuing its own life into 2021. I'm hopeful that we'll see at least not a cessation of it, but some ebbing of the passion of the aggrievements. I'm hoping that when we don't have Trump on the air every day fanning the flames, that even if there's still people with those aggrieved feelings, they'll cool down a little bit. They won't have a cheerleader in the bully pulpit to help whip them up. And I'm hoping that, well, I know that those people, Trump didn't create those people. Those people created Trump. He did play them like a fiddle. And I hope that when there's no fiddler, that maybe we'll see some return to a greater degree of civility, some greater sense that we're all in this together, less of a regional movement, as we've seen with, you know, Quebec is flirting with it again, though very much on the fringes, but Alberta talking about exiting, which again is also fringe. They just happen to have a lot of loudspeakers and media once again zeroing in on something that could be a real juicy story. I would just like to see in 2021 our political discourse and political culture return to something with a greater degree of civility. Whether it'll happen or not, I don't know. I think it'll have a lot to do with, does Trump actually exit the White House or not, willingly? Is it going to be something like martial law?
Are they going to be, going to be like finger ruts in the carpet as they drag him by the ankles out of the White House?
Yeah. Is he going to be in it? Because carrying him out is going to be hard because he's a bit hefty. but we will have to see. And, you know, the best we can do is hope, but keep our eyes out for all the signs of what is and what's going to be. And well, those who listen to us will have us here to continue to boil the world down to more chewable bites.
Well, and I hope that 2021 does, like you said, become a little bit calmer. I think Biden is a calming influence. Just his energy level, if nothing else, is a lot less, and a little more considered. And you hope that there's still a constituency for that, for people who go like, oh, I forgot how normal felt.
Yeah.
That I don't have to worry every morning. I don't have to turn on CNN or MSNBC and go, oh, what crazy thing has the president been tweeting from the toilet at 3 a.m? Yeah. Just to go back to that. I mean, I think Trudeau has done a pretty good job of not rising to a lot of the
bait
that has been tossed out by either the NDP or the Conservative Party. I mean, there's back and forth in the House of Commons, but no one really pays too much attention to that. I think the Liberals try to take a more even tone when it comes to this kind of stuff. I hope there is still a market for that, and that 2021 is a return to a certain amount of normalcy. I think Trump will start to disappear. I think, he will make noise as long as he's making money from it. This whole idea of running in 2024, I don't think he has any interest in running in 2024. I think he has interest in having crowds that cheer his name. And I think as long as he can keep passing the hat at those events, he will do that and pocket the money. But I don't think he's going to be much of a political force going forward. And if the Democrats, I think it's a long shot that they're going to flip the Senate with the two Georgia seats. But but if they do and they control both houses and the presidency, then I think maybe there can be some progress made in the United States. I mean, undoing some of the terrible things that have happened and getting rid of the gridlock and getting some of the stuff that have been sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk forever and just can't go forward because of just plain old Republican obstructionism. I think things can go back to normal a little bit, and hopefully people will like that. Because I think a lot of people have just forgotten how it could be by living in this incredibly polarized world and this lurching from catastrophe and outrage to the next.
Well, we shall see, and I'm going to be hopeful. It's the season of hope, so I'm going to be hopeful that things will get better, not dramatically different, but better. When COVID lifts or ceases to have its grip on us, because we have many people vaccinated or the whole nation vaccinated eventually, things will get back to normal and people can open their businesses and people can go out without masks, without being asked to wear a mask. So there's nobody arguing that they don't want to wear a mask. I think that there are signs and portents that 2021 could be a better year for us than 2020, as long as this variant of COVID that they've discovered doesn't prove to be vaccine resistant. I'm just hoping that it's a better year.
It could hardly miss.
The bar is low.
Yeah, exactly. And if not, I've been going to the liquor store on a regular basis and building up a fairly good supply. So I'm ready for anything.
Well, I know whose house to go to. All right. Stephen, thank you very much. And of course, I've enjoyed our conversations over the past year. And I think that I really appreciate the number of people who listen and who feed back. I'm glad that we're able to provide some illumination on what's going on in the world for people. It's a privilege to be able to do so. And I'm glad for everybody who listens to the podcast on a regular basis.
Yeah, and likewise, I've been really, I'm always pleased to hear from our listeners, whether it's on Twitter or Facebook. And it's a real, like you say, it's a real privilege to be able to go into people's homes once in a while and visit with them. And it doesn't mean everyone's always going to agree with us. Doesn't mean that you and I always agree on everything either. But it's nice to be able to have some civilized discord in this increasingly uncivilized world.
Well, and quite frankly, us coming into their homes may be the only visitors they've been allowed to have during the lockdown. So
as long as we wash our hands first, we're good.
That's right. All right, Stephen, the best to you and yours for a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Well, thank you, and the best of the season to you as well. And let's hope that 2021 treats us a little more gently than 2020 did.
And we're going to take a break, but we'll be back again first week of January, and we'll get in the starters blocks and get ready to go. All right, Stephen, the best to you, and
you too.
Thank you for everything, and to all of you. Very Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Best of the season, as Stephen says, for whatever you're celebrating, however you're celebrating it. Wish you the best and thank you for continuing to listen. And we'll be talking to you again soon here on Stephen and Stephen on the Fun Network.